Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly report to you about the economic events and movements and trends that shape our lives, our incomes, our jobs, our debts, our futures, the costs of educating our children, all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. I wanted to also take a moment to thank all of you that listen for making the last 3 years a remarkable time in my life, and I hope in yours. This is the third anniversary of the beginning of this program. We started very modestly, thanks to the invitation of WBAI in New York City. And now we come to you on radio stations across the United States, from San Francisco and Los Angeles in California, all the way back to New York, from Peoria, Illinois in the north, to Tampa, Florida, and Houston, Texas, and Santa Fe, New Mexico, in the southern parts of our country. It is a very gratifying experience, made even more so by now beginning television broadcasting of this program on MNN, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, in Manhattan in New York City, and hopefully branching beyond that as well. It is extraordinary what has happened. The interest in this kind of work is simply exploding. And so I want to thank you for all the emails you've sent, all the encouragement, and all the support. And the growing audience is the best compliment I can get. I also want to thank truthout.org, which regularly sends out this program as well to hundreds of thousands of its subscribers across the United States. If you're interested in this program and what we do, please know that you can follow all the connections, linkages, get access to even more materials by visiting either of our two websites. They're available 24/7, no charge whatsoever. The first one is rdwolff.com, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. In both of those websites, you will find not only interesting materials, but you'll find a way to sign up for our newsletter. Every 2 or 3 months, we send, again, without no charge whatsoever, a newsletter updating you on our activities and how you can follow us on radio and television and so forth. We urge you to sign up for that. You can also, by either email, communicate to us what you like, don't like about the program, what you'd like to see us cover. We read and deal with every single email we get. We respond to the few that we have the time for. I ask your understanding that we get such a flood, we couldn't possibly, with our staff, respond to them all. But we do read them, and we use them to shape these programs and every content on them. So, if any of this is of interest to you, please make yourselves aware of and make use of these two websites that are there for you, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. And through both of those websites, you can also follow us, which we urge you to do, on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Let me turn then to the updates for this week's program. Very much in the news over the last week or two has been an immense recall of automobiles by the General Motors Corporation. And I want to talk a little bit about that recall, what it involves, and I think, most importantly, what it means. Let's begin back in 2009, not that many years ago. The General Motors Corporation was effectively bankrupt. The economic crisis took it over the edge, and we faced the possibility that our largest automobile company in the United States would go belly up, close operations, affecting huge numbers of people in countless ways. The corporation asked for, and the United States government responded, by an immense, costly bailout of General Motors. Something on the order of $50 billion of taxpayer money, your money, my money, was made available at effectively no cost for years and years to help the General Motors Corporation get out of its disastrous situation. As part of the deals that were struck, not only did General Motors get $50 billion of cash, but more importantly, it got all kinds of special considerations. One of them is of special interest. The General Motors Corporation was basically given exemption from lawsuits for any known at that time, defects that might subject the company to lawsuits. Keep that in mind, please. Why? We now know that as far back as 2001, that is 8 years before the bailout, General Motors knew that they had a serious problem with a faulty ignition. Basically, this problem was that if you had a heavy keychain with a key sticking in the ignition, or you bumped the ignition with your leg, it could turn off, basically losing for the driver and his/her passengers the protections of airbags and other electronically controlled devices. So far, the General Motors Corporation has admitted to knowing about 31 crashes and 12 deaths from those crashes since 2001. But in the nature of these things, everyone who observes this expects that that number will rise as the lawsuits of people hurt, killed, those who lost loved ones, proliferates. In the latest recall, the General Motors Corporation is recalling not only vehicles with faulty ignitions, but it turns out that there is more trouble because there were brake problems and other problems with faulty airbags. And so most recently, over 1 million cars were recalled by General Motors with these other defects. This causes losses to all kinds of people. Turns out, for example, that the value of a car, if you own one that's been recalled, is considerably less in the used car market than the value of a car that has not been subject to a recall for all kinds of obvious reasons. Note also that here we have a disaster that cannot be blamed on the operator of the car. Most recently, the Toyota company was in trouble because of unexplained surges of the car. The Toyota company tried to suggest on occasions that this was operator failure, that the people driving the car inadvertently stepped on the gas or had some other kind of event like that. But in the case of a brake failure and in the case of an ignition failure, blaming the individual, the General Motors hasn't even tried for that. Why do I bring this up? Folks on the stock market are telling us not to worry, that General Motors can't be effectively sued because when we bailed them out with $50 billion, we also gave them an effective protection from lawsuits. The people filing the lawsuits counter by saying, oh no, you only got that protection because you vouched at the time of the bailout that you had no known defects that might subject you to lawsuits. But you now admit you knew well before 2009 that there were defects, that there had been crashes and deaths, and that you were certainly subject to likely lawsuits, which have now become a reality. How is General Motors dealing with this problem? Well, here I rely particularly on a story in the Bloomberg Businessweek website, March 18th, by one Paul Barrett. The problem here is the following, that General Motors has a new chairperson, Mary Barra. It's the first woman chairperson in the company's history. And so one is entitled to wonder whether she is now the face of General Motors, precisely because they know they have an enormous problem with public anger over having spent a fortune to bail out a company whose thanks to the community is by hiding, in effect, a defect, getting exemption from lawsuits by hiding it, subjecting people to all kinds of danger by hiding it, subjecting people to all kinds of losses in the value of their automobiles, because when this hidden material comes out, the value of your car shrinks. The response of the new chief at General Motors, Mary Barra, who, by the way, was an engineer before, occupied for many years a very high position in General Motors. She says she knew nothing about it. Well, that's even scarier than the notion she did and isn't telling the truth, because she's a top engineer and didn't know anything about a major defect involving millions of cars for over a decade. There is no way out of the conclusion. Major capitalist corporations will do virtually anything, even at the risk of life and limb, to make money. They will take handouts from the government of huge amounts of people's money. They will manipulate those handouts to get even more advantages and hide behind them to secure profits. There is something fundamentally wrong in a system that presents this kind of story in one variation or another so often for so long a time. The second update I want to bring you, I want to thank Jesse Vaught of Portland, New York, who brought this to my attention. And when I get interesting information from my listeners or viewers, I would like to be able to thank you. So if you're willing to let me do that, please let me know. Jesse Vaught did so. The Los Angeles Times on the 13th of March carried a story by Kenneth Weiss. It was about women working in the garment factories of Bangladesh, a country on the other side of the world in Asia. It's a country about which Americans generally know very little, but it's a very important country in many ways. First, it's got a very big population, half that of the United States. So this is a country half as big as the United States, which makes it bigger than most countries in the world. Number two, it produces an enormous portion of the garments worn in the United States, in Europe, and other parts of the world. It is a major producer of clothing. Indeed, in Bangladesh, the Los Angeles Times made covered 5,600 factories employing 4 million workers, garment district, the garment section of the industry in Bangladesh. 90% of these workers are women. Bangladesh women producing the clothing for so many of the folks in North America and Western Europe and other parts of the world. How much did the woman featured in the Los Angeles Times story, how much did she work? Well, she worked 52 weeks of the year, and we're assuming about 40 hours a week. She got paid for that $20 per week, or $1,040 per year. Half of that money she sent back to her family living in the rural parts of Bangladesh. She recently participated in demonstrations in Dhaka and other parts of Bangladesh of garment workers who were successful in raising their minimum wage to $68 a month, which works out to 33 cents an hour for a typical worker. Why do I tell you this? For several reasons. I want us to understand what the conditions are in the places that now make the basic goods and services we in the West buy. 33 cents an hour. half of which these women workers send back to support their families in the places they came from. This is an unspeakable condition of life. They are crowded in tenements that are unsafe and unlivable. They cannot take care of their basic medical needs, personal hygiene, and so on. They live an extraordinarily difficult life. But they are making possible enormous profits. Clothing made there is very cheap because the workers aren't paid. It is shipped back to Europe and North America, where it sells for a hefty price, even if it looks like a discount to us, generating enormous profits that are shared between the local capitalists in Bangladesh and the big importers of clothing and the department stores that sell you that stuff here in the United States or in Western Europe. It is therefore part of the movement of capitalism away from North America and Western Europe, which is why we have such high unemployment, such deteriorating job conditions. And those capitalists are making a fortune as our situation deteriorates by being able to exploit workers like those in Bangladesh. It is something to think long and hard about that an economic system works this way. That we're told to be glad about the profitability of the companies doing this and not to think about what it means both for the workers in Bangladesh and for those unemployed in the West. The third update for today is in some ways the one I found most striking. And this comes from a dispatch from Reuters, the international news service, dated March 14. And this is a report based on a banking overview consultancy, a company that keeps track of what's happening in banks. And here's what they report, as reported by the Reuters News Service. Four American companies have had to provide documents, which this watchdog group looked at and Reuters verified. Apple, Microsoft, Google, and Cisco. Together, they have avoided paying taxes on something on the order of $250 billion of profits those corporations made. And under the existing law, if they don't bring those profits back to the United States, they don't have to pay taxes. So keep that in mind. They keep these monies in foreign bank accounts. The one in Reuters being based in Britain, their research is particularly focused on money kept in British banks, but not only there. But this $255 billion is profits earned by the company that they keep in banks abroad so they don't have to pay taxes. But obviously, by getting out of paying taxes, these already very profitable, rich, growing companies, kind of the model companies of American capitalism these days, Apple, Microsoft, Google, and Cisco, by them keeping money out there, they're depriving the United States Treasury of hundreds of billions, if you add it up over the years, of taxes. And that plunges the federal government in Washington into a dilemma. They need money to operate. What do they do? Well, they cut a good bit of what they do, but what they mostly do is borrow the money because they can't get the taxes. So the Treasury borrows money. Now, here comes the really good part. Who lends the government money? Who buys the Treasury securities, which is the way the federal government buys money? It prints these securities, and then it sells them to people. People give the government money, they get a security, and the security is like an IOU. It's the federal government saying, we'll pay you back the money with interest while you wait, because we have to borrow from you like that since we don't have enough taxes to do what the federal government is committed to do, whether that be providing for highways and roads, to fighting wars, to making loans to students, whatever. So here's the beautiful part of this, if you have a sense of beauty that has a tinge of irony in it. One of the things Apple, Microsoft, Google, and Cisco do with the money they save from paying taxes to Uncle Sam on the profits they earned is they lend the money to Uncle Sam. They buy those treasury securities. Most recently, $124 billion worth of them. So let's see, make sure everybody gets this. Those companies don't pay the taxes that they ought to on the profits they earn, a good part of them. They put that money in banks, but to earn more money than they get by putting the money in the bank, they lend the money to the government. So by not paying the government taxes, they force the government, in effect, to borrow. Then they say, hello, I'm here, borrow from me. And in that way, by not paying taxes, they get to lend the government money, meaning that not only do they deprive the government of taxes, but they drain the government of its money by requiring the government to pay interest on the money borrowed from the same four companies that didn't pay their taxes. This would, in any other kind of business, be called a hustle, because that's what it is. We get to be deprived of the taxes we need while having to pay interest on top of that indignity to the people who've avoided paying the taxes. Extraordinary. I want to turn now to the first of our more major discussions in the remaining first half of the program today. And this one has to do with the relationship between unequal distribution of income on the one hand and how long we live, longevity, on the other. I was struck by a story in the New York Times on March 16th devoted to this topic and based on very careful statistical research. This research plotted for every county in the 50 states of the United States, so for the entire population of this country, it plotted what was the median family income in each county. In other words, what was that level of income that had 50% of the people of the county living at a lower family income and 50% at a higher family income for all the counties? And together, this statistical survey also asked for each county not only what was the median income, but what was the average length of life of the population as a whole and of men and women looked at separately. And the idea was to get a notion of whether there was any relationship that could be seen statistically between the level of income families enjoyed and how long they lived. And the results, as published in the New York Times, were unambiguous and crystal clear. And not only were they unambiguous and crystal clear in a way I'm about to tell you, but they didn't change in the important way I'm going to describe to you between the first time this study was done, 1990, and today. So over a 25 or 24 year span. Here's what the statistics showed. The higher your median income in a county, the longer you live. As median incomes went from roughly $30,000 a year per family, all the way up to $120,000 per year per family, the effective range of this research, you could see a direct gain. And so the people at the upper end, the people who lived in counties where the median income was over $100,000, lived a good 10 years or more longer than those who were at the bottom. Even though everybody lives longer today than they did back in 1990 by a little bit, what hasn't changed is the relationship between income and longevity, which means, and there's no way out of this, that if we keep people at low income levels, we are cutting off life itself. The statistics show that whatever else is going on, If you have a lower income, in on the average, you're going to live less long. And that means that if we cut off people's food stamps, if we don't give them extended unemployment benefits when they're out of work, if we don't make the tax system redistribute some of the wealth that has been initially distributed so unfairly and unequally to begin with. In other words, if we don't take one or another of the steps needed, raising the minimum wage, providing government jobs if the private sector either won't provide you with a job or won't provide you with one at a decent livable income. If we don't do that, we are effectively condemning those at the bottom, and we're talking millions and millions of families. We're condemning them to an early death. Let me drive this point home in yet another way. When the Obamacare legislation was first brought forward, conservative loudspeakers blared out an idea about quote-unquote death panels. Here the idea, which was a twisting of what the law actually did, said, well, we're going to have to deal with the fact that the overwhelming bulk of medical care is required by people in the last months and years of their lives, and we have to take into account that if we are going to economize on health care, we have to deal with what that might mean for those folks. It didn't, of course, mean that anyone was going to be condemned to death or anything like that. It was a question of how you manage a health care system when such a disproportionate amount of the health care is required by people at the end of their lives. But that dispute, a bit of a tempest in a teapot, is nowhere near as realistic as what that story in the New York Times teaches us. If we don't raise the median income of the lower half to two-thirds of the American people, we are knowingly condemning them to live less long than people whose difference is they earn more money. Is it justified? Is it justifiable to give you time on this earth according to the amount of money you earn, independent of whether that money comes from assets you inherited from wealthy relatives, from the luck of where you went to school, from your own capability, from the incidence of illness, divorce, or anything else that can happen to anyone? Are we going to make it a situation where you are, in fact, condemned to an earlier death than you ought to be? Obamacare didn't have that result. That was hype. But our refusal to deal with the inequality in our society does have the effect of condemning our population as a whole to a reality that the New York Times shows has not changed, not since 1990, not in the last 25 years, and I am quite confident that if the research were extended further back, it would only reinforce the point. Inequality kills. People are losing years of life for themselves, their loved ones, and those dependent on them because they are kept at levels of income that come out of the kind of salary you get at Walmart or McDonald's or countless other employers that pay so little that you're condemned to be in that group that is in effect told they're not allowed to live as long as the other folks in the society that have a higher income. I doubt very much that such a situation, which, by the way, has survived in the United States over the last 24 years, despite all the programs we were supposed to believe made such a thing a matter of the past, didn't work. Every effort to improve that situation didn't work. Our No Child Left Behind educational reforms didn't change this. Our alternate diets didn't change this. Our government programs didn't change this. Built into our society is a relationship between the income you get and the length of life you get to enjoy. And a society that can't get around that better deal with it. better make it no longer the case that some of us earn way less than others of us, because it is not fair and it is dangerous to the length of your life. Please stay with me as we take our usual short break. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update, and I'll be back with you in a matter of seconds. Richard Wolff, this is Economic Update. I want to remind you again that we maintain two websites where you can pursue whatever interests you on these programs, see a great deal of additional material, communicate to us, and also follow us by a simple click on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. The two website addresses are these: rdwolff with two F's .com. rdwolff.com, and the second one, democracyatwork.info. A further thought, on both those websites, you can sign up at no cost for our regular newsletter, and every 2 or 3 months, you will get a communication from us via email with some of the recent activities we're doing that you can pursue or not, as your preference dictates. The second major conversation today is a response to a sizable number of emails that you have sent me. And you wanted me to talk about capitalism. And interestingly, several of your emails said you would really appreciate a careful, systematic definition, because you hear the word, but you don't know exactly what people mean, which I understand, and which is not your problem. It's the problem that this word is used to mean a whole host of different things. Rather like many important words in the language, they get to have multiple meanings. So I'm going to talk about the major meanings, and then you've also asked me to offer a systematic and careful critique, because as many of you pointed out, even if you know or have a clear idea of what capitalism means, the criticism of it is something you don't hear very often and that you would like to have spelled out so that you could consider it and draw your own conclusions. So let me do that. First, what is capitalism? Well, it's the name for the economic system, and it's basically the name for the economic system we have today. Capitalism is generally dated back to around the 18th century, where it began in England, which is not to say that there weren't examples of capitalism back earlier in history, but 18th century England is when capitalism becomes the dominant economic system for a whole society, for a whole country. And from England it spread first to Western Europe, and from there to North America, and eventually to the whole world. Whereas today you can say that the whole world is predominantly organized in a capitalist way. Whereas that was not the case before the 18th century. Before the 18th century in Europe, the system is called feudalism, existed in Europe for 1,000 years. Before that, slavery. Before that, other words are used, tribal society, sometimes primitive society, lots of different words. But capitalism is, in a sense, the latest in a list of different economic systems. You should be also aware that in every economic system, the following took place. First, there were people who loved the system, celebrated it, praised it, who believed it was the best the human brain could devise, way better than what preceded it, and not in need of any major change, because in the end it was a kind of finale, peak of human history, and the important thing was to preserve it. Then there were also people in every economic system who didn't agree, who thought the economic system left much to be desired, that it had major flaws, weaknesses, that parts of it, or all of it, were unjust, inappropriate, that the human race could and should do better. And these people carried on a lively debate and discussion for many years. Then, of course, sometimes the conversation tilted. Those who were celebrants decided that those who were critical should be silenced. And sometimes they succeeded, and sometimes they didn't. On the other hand, those who were critical were sometimes able to say, not only does this system have flaws, but we're going to begin to take action to go beyond this system, to establish a new and different system to do better. And if they succeeded, we sometimes look back and say, well, that was a revolution. So, for example, the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century is often referred to as a point in which feudalism, the old system, was overthrown and a new system was established. Okay, with that as the background, what exactly is the capitalist system? Well, in general, three things stand out, and that most definitions focus on one or all of them. First, the means of production, the land, the machines, the equipment, everything that goes into production is privately owned. It is some private person, individual person's property. And that person has the right to make what he or she owns available for production or to withhold it. So if you have a piece of land, you can make it available to someone who farms it, or you can refuse. Likewise, if you have machinery or money, you can make it available. We call that investing in production, or you can withhold it. And the worker, too, can make his or her labor available or withhold it. So capitalism is a system where we allow private individuals to decide whether and how to make available whatever they have to the production process. The second characteristic of capitalism is that resources that people have, just like the products that come out of production, move from one person to another by means of an exchange. I'll give you so many shirts, you give me that many bushels of potatoes. I will give you this software, you give me so many dollars of your money, and so on. That is, the distribution of goods and resources is handled by market exchanges, voluntary decisions of human beings to give up so much of what they have to get so much of what somebody else has. So capitalism is most often defined as private property in the means of production and market exchange as the mechanism of distributing productive resources and outputs. Some people stop there. For them, capitalism is private ownership and markets. And in the last 100 years, capitalism has been challenged mostly by a system called socialism. And the difference of socialism, generally discussed, is that you don't have private ownership, you have government ownership. That is, the factories, the money, the machines, the land, is taken over by the government in the name of the whole people. The property is socialized, or sometimes the word is used, nationalized. And it's then the job of the government to make the decisions of what part of it, of all that it owns, tools, equipment, factories, land, to make it available for what kind of production under what conditions. So we socialize the means of production, which is one of the reasons it's called socialism. And the other thing that socialism does that's different from capitalism, it doesn't allow markets to be the way goods and services are distributed, or at least it doesn't allow only markets to do that. It also superimposes on markets, or sometimes displaces markets, and substitutes planning. Government officials will move the resources from here to there, will take the output of shirts and distribute them to these stores in these places, attaching these prices. In other words, you have more planning by the government rather than markets, just like you have more social ownership of the means of production rather than private ownership. So we've had 100 years of struggle between capitalism, a system of private ownership and markets, versus socialism, a system of social ownership and planning. But the definition of capitalism has also been extended by many, myself included, to include something that we believe is at least as important as who owns the means of production and what mechanism is used to move resources and products around the society from the producers of them to the consumers of them. And what we focus on is the organization of production. How is the production of goods and services that we all depend on to live? Clothing, shelter, food, and so on. How is that organized? In capitalism, a tiny group of people, the entrepreneur, the board of directors of a corporation, the major shareholders, the few people who own the deciding portions of an enterprise, they make the decisions. They alone decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that everybody helps to produce. All the workers that come to work, that are hired by the board of directors and the major shareholders and so on, hired by the employer. The employers are small in number, the employees are large. The large number, the employees, depend on the decisions made by a few. They decide, you live with it. If they decide to close the factory, you have no job. If they decide to use a dangerous technology, you either have to breathe that air or quit and look for another job. If they decide to take the profits that you and your labor helped to produce and use it to pay big dividends to shareholders and big salary packages to top executives, their decision governs. You are left with whatever is left. Okay, that situation isn't the only way to organize production. So there's an alternative. Here's the alternative. You could arrange it so that all the workers in an enterprise together democratically participate in making all those decisions, that it isn't left anymore to a tiny number of people, major shareholders, board of directors selected by major shareholders. You could govern the production process differently. It could be a community democratic decision-making. And the critique of capitalism has always focused on these three, on private ownership, on social ownership as an alternative, on markets and on planning as an alternative, and on a top-down, undemocratic, hierarchical organization of production, which is capitalist, versus a collective and democratically run enterprise by the workers in it, which is the alternative. And criticism has been on that. So let me begin, and we won't finish it today, and we'll carry it over a little bit more. The subject of a critique of capitalism is certainly important, because we want to be a healthy society. And in a healthy society, the critics of the economic system we live under have to be heard and have to be encouraged so that we can compare those who celebrate it and the reasons they give and those who criticize and the reasons they give. It is an unhealthy society that bans either one. It's an unhealthy society that is too afraid of exposing its system to criticism. That kind of a society is headed for trouble. And we've lived in that kind of society for the last half a century, in which the criticism of capitalism, instead of being something we want to have as a healthy society should, has attempted to be banned as somehow a brand of disloyalty, as somehow a brand of not being a good American. Clever game to play, good way to try to shut people up, but in the end, we lose, because if we don't have critics, we don't identify flaws, failures, problems. And you know, if you don't identify them early, they get worse. We've talked about that. So let's begin. One of the things that's been criticized about capitalism is precisely that the ownership of the means of production, the ownership of the enterprises, is private. Why is that a problem? Well, the argument is simple. If it's privately owned, it'll be used to advance and advantage the private owner. That is, the private owner of a piece of land will use it, most of the time, in a way that's best for him or her, and not necessarily in the way that is best for the community as a whole. It's easy to give you an example. Imagine a piece of land. The piece of land could grow food for a hungry community, or it could be an open piece of land where the wealthy person who owns the land can go fox hunting, riding a horse, and dressed in a lovely red outfit. Under the private ownership of the means of production, the owner of that land has the right, protected by the law, to withhold that piece of land from being made available to produce goods for people to eat, and to use it instead for his private enjoyment. That's what private ownership, private enterprise, means. Ditto, to take a more modern example. If you're a private owner of a company, and you learn that you can employ women in Bangladesh for 33 cents an hour, rather than employing workers here in the United States for $10, $20, or $30 an hour, you decide, whoa, I want to make more money. I want to produce a shirt I can sell for $30 in Bangladesh, where it costs next to nothing, rather than in the United States. And because I'm the private owner, I can do that. And I can make a lot of money in Bangladesh and ship the shirt back here. And I don't have any responsibilities for the American workers who lose their job. If they lose their job, their family loses their income. That means the family might economize on the children's medical care. It means that family can't pay taxes to the community in which it lives. All kinds of people will suffer because of a lost job in a clothing factory that shuts its doors in the United States and moves to Bangladesh. Now, here's a simple economic calculation. On the one hand, we put the advantage to the individual who moved his factory to Bangladesh. Let's say it's $25,000 a year extra profit for him. So he does it. Extra for me, I'm doing it. I'm making $25,000 a year more. But then we come in, we thinking people, and we measure the extra cost to society of the family whose breadwinners are of the families whose breadwinners are unemployed, of the extra burden on the community that unemployment implies, on the extra stress and mental crises of the family that lives through it. And we add up all those costs. And we can point out, because this exercise has been done and is not difficult, we can point out that the losses to society, added up from the decision to move the factory, are much more than $25,000. Let's say $50,000. Okay, but we live in a capitalist society. So that even though we can show that the benefit of moving to the private owner of $25,000 was less than the loss to the community as a whole, $50,000, there's nothing that can be done by the community in a capitalist system to stop it. Because in a private enterprise system with private ownership, we leave the decision where you locate production to the private owner, who will do it in his, her own interest. And so we've lost, over the last 40 years, thousands of companies and millions of jobs that way. The net loss to the American economy has been huge, and I would argue far greater than the private profit earned by those who made the moves. A critic of capitalism raises that issue and says that's a cost of capitalism that an honest society ought to debate. Is it worth it? Are the gains we think we get from private capitalism worth the losses we suffer in the example I've given you? Before we do another critique, and our time is limited, I wanted to also suggest that private enterprise leaves a very important decision to the private entrepreneur, to the individual. Here's the decision. Do I invest the money I have? I've made a good bit of money this year. Let's take a good company doing well as an example. And I need to decide whether I'm going to take my profits and invest them, grow the company, go into another business or not. And I look around and I make that decision. If I decide to invest, then the question is, where do I decide to invest? I might decide to invest in China. Then it means lots of good jobs for people in China. If I decide to invest in Australia, it means jobs in Australia. If I decide to invest in New York City, it means jobs there. In other words, the jobs, the lives, the families, the communities, the very countries around the world depend on decisions of individuals. Wow. Is that reasonable? Well, you might ask, gee, we shouldn't have the well-being of many depend on a decision of the few. We normally believe in a democracy that if you're affected by a decision, you ought to have some participation in it. But the investment decision is left to the feelings, hopes, dreams, guessworks about the future of a very small number of us, the so-called investors, those with the money to have anything to invest, those in a position to decide, which is a tiny minority of our society. Is that a reasonable way to organize so important a decision as whether or not you invest and create jobs, and if you do, for whom, where? Now, if we had a world economy that the capitalists of the world had invested in, so that we had a reasonably equal, not exactly, of course, but roughly comparable development around the world, we might not want to raise this criticism. But suppose I told you, as I have in previous programs, and as I assume you know, that Western Europe and North America are very, very rich, and people in many other parts of the world are very, very poor. That's one of the reasons I began today with the story of Bangladesh. Clearly, 33 cents an hour is a completely different life from billions that you earn a year, which billionaires around the world get. So capitalism hasn't distributed the benefits of itself in an equitable way, by no stretch of the imagination. On the contrary, capitalism has distributed its benefits very unequally. The mass of people have been bypassed, and a relatively small number have been given a disproportionate benefit. This is the basis for an honest criticism. This is not to say that these arguments have no rejoinders, have no counter-arguments. Of course they do. The point is, we tend to hear, particularly in the United States, lots and lots of arguments for the virtues and benefits of capitalism, and very rarely a critique. You will search long and hard in the annals of the United States House of Representatives or the Senate to hear any one of the men and women there offer a sustained critique of capitalism. That's why it's left to independent media like this one to make that available to you. And we will continue next week with more on the critique of capitalism, so at least you have a sense of its sophistication, of its having been worked out by intelligent people over a long period of time, and in short, being that other side of the question you should have had presented to you as part of your education, but were denied because of the fearfulness of a society caught up in a Cold War. In the final minutes that remain for us, one quick question sent in by one of you. You've heard on a television program, one of you said, that investors said that they chose to invest in an economy if the spirit drove them to do that. And you wrote to me and said, is that really something like spirits? And the answer is economists have had to use words like spirits because it's kind of hard to pin down how and why investors decide when and whether to invest. You know, if a big business sees trouble coming down the road in the economy next year or the year after, they will hold back on investment. If they think that money is to be made, they'll make the investment. All of us depend, for how good the economy is, on the decision of a tiny minority. So we're very interested in what moves them. And so it's often important to understand, yes, investors invest when the spirit moves them, but what's really interesting is, when do they decide not to? When do they decide to do it? And really the big question is, should we allow something as important as investment to be determined by whatever is in the minds of the relatively small number of people who control most investment? We'll pick up with that in the future. I want to thank you for being with me. This is Economic Update. I am Richard Wolff, and I hope you will enjoy coming and visiting with us next week. Thing gonna change. Yes, it is.